Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself.
We have with us here today a bike riding clinical psychologist from Indianapolis named Jim Ganji, who, as you will soon hear, has maintained a high-level professional position while also bike commuting an average of 40 miles a day. Among other things, he will tell us what we as individual cyclists can do to change the attitudes of those in cars with whom we share the road.
Okay, Jim, so how are you doing today out there in Indianapolis?
I'm doing well, Martin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, guy.
Good.
Excellent. So let's start things off by you're a psychologist back there in Indianapolis, and that would mean
I am. I have a PhD in clinical psychology.
Oh, wow. Okay. You pretty much answered my question for me. I was going to ask if you are a PhD. So how long have you been in practice in Indy? Short for...
In Indianapolis, about 25 years.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And how many of those years have you been biking?
All of them. I was biking when I moved here. I bicycled as an intern at the University of Minnesota Medical Center.
Wow.
In Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
And I just continued doing it once I got here.
So 25 years, that would mean that you would have been started in 1980, 81?
Yes.
Okay.
I moved to Indianapolis in 81.
Okay, great. So I was there on a bicycle in 1979. So, yeah, it's going to be when I passed across the United States the first time. So we're going to have an interesting study of reference points here. Because the next one I ask you, do you remember the pre-Ray Irvin days?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do. I rode before Ray really got the greenways going here in Indianapolis. And it was quite a different...
Well, 1979, yeah. It was kind of like people hadn't hardly even seen a 10-speed. So you work a lot with people's attitudes.
I do. I was actually... Okay. I work a lot with children right now. Mm-hmm. and also with parents. And
okay.
I worked in medical settings and that type of thing. And a lot of it is changing the attitudes towards, a lot of therapy really involves changing attitudes either towards themselves or towards other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, when people from California think of Indianapolis, they think of the Indy 500. That's what comes to mind for a lot of people. And and yet,
it's occurring right now.
Oh, okay. And it's like cars are king in Indianapolis and in the mind's eye of Californians. However, from talking with Ray, the podcast we did with him, and that which I'm learning about Indy, which of course is short for Indianapolis, you guys know otherwise. You guys know that there's a different Indy there than what we see in our television sets, those of us that tune in to watch the Indy 500, like to listen to all that noise.
Right.
And it's not just about car racing and the manufacture of automobiles and service and things like that. Those don't predominate in Indy. There's supposedly a lot of high tech and biotech and marketing and IT, et cetera. Do you see that?
Yes,
okay.
There is. I mean, I worked at the Med Center, and it is a really a research hub for medical research, and with Lilly. Pharmaceutical here, headquarters in town. There's really a science base here in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Purdue University, which is engineering and medical engineering, is just up 50 miles north, and Indiana University Bloomington is just 50 miles south. So there, it really is a center for science, technology, as well as amateur sports. There's a world-class natatorium. There's lots of swimming, rowing, running. So there's as well as cycling. We have the major Taylor Velodrome here in town.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of interest in sports in Indianapolis that's not related to motor racing.
Great. So now, in that transitional process where you've seen the mindset change from the gun rack farmer boy mindset to kind of a more what Richard Florida and Ray Irvin both call the creative class, and you've seen the mindset has changed, things like that. Within the context of all that, you've also written a highly regarded essay entitled "Warm Your Heart Passing a Gas Station." It's about bike commuting. Can you give us a quick synopsis of what that's all about?
Well, I ride my bicycle for commuting to two job sites, and it's about 40 miles a day between the two sites. And so,
wait, time out. I want to underscore that 40 miles a day he rides.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Not all at once.
Okay. Still a lot of miles.
It's a lot of miles, and I try and ride throughout the winter if the streets aren't iced up. Well, I was asked by several people, both at work and through other bicycling interest clubs, how you do it. How do you get started? If you were interested in riding a bicycle for commuting to work or to the store or something like that, how do you get started? And so I wrote this article in which I talked about the process of how I plan out routes, planning a safe route to work or adding miles to the route so that you could, pick up a river, ride along a river or a creek or just make it more enjoyable. Or even if it's just, avoiding busy roads or higher crime areas or, railroad tracks. I talked in the article about, I try to answer the questions that frequently come up, questions about hygiene, how do you, you work in a professional area, you have to wear, a shirt and a tie, and, how do you do that riding a bicycle? So I try to address those areas, as well as, practical, what do you do when you encounter dogs, what do you encounter, how about when it rains or snows, and so I tried to address those. And I wrote it last fall, right after gasoline prices took a major rise, because the people in CIBA, the Central Indiana Bicycling Association, and I noticed that there were a lot more bicyclists on the road carrying packs or panniers and appeared to be commuting, using their bicycles for commuting. And so that's why I wrote the article. And it was posted on the CIBA website at cibaride.org.
Okay, so if someone wanted to find that, they'd look for, they'd key in "Warm Your Heart Passing a Gas Station"? Is that?
Yeah, they can go to org and then just go to the commuting section.
Okay, so Jim, in terms of Indianapolis, I'm going to kind of hold Ray Irvin's from Indy Greenways, Mr. Greenway. I'm going to hold his feet to the fire on this one. You as a cyclist, 25 years there in Indianapolis, has his Greenway Trail building there in Indy made it easier for you on the road?
It is. I mean, I think that the more, what the Greenways did is it made a long trail, and not just the Monon Trail, but several other trails that are connect together, and it has just encouraged cycling. And the difference is that motorists are more aware that they're sharing the road, or they're supposed to be sharing the road with cyclists. So even though there's no more vehicles on the trail, there are a lot more cyclists out on the road than there were before Ray was able to get the Greenway Trail established.
Okay. Now, do you find those are useful, the trails? Do you make them, do you build them into your commuting exercise as well?
I take the trails for just a short period of time. Most of my riding is on city streets.
Okay.
There's maybe a few miles on the actual Greenway.
Okay, and you don't have a lot of bike lane miles there, is that correct?
No, we don't. Indianapolis is really far behind cities our size for bike lane that are established.
And yet, do you find that with Ray, because of Ray, that the competition you experience with motorists for your share of the road is probably, it's a little bit more tempered. It's been easier for you now.
Well, yeah, I think it has made a difference. Well, this part of Indiana is pretty flat, and the roadways are actually pretty wide, so you could design a route to get to most places. Where you're pretty much I mean, you're riding with traffic, but it's not like you're on a narrow two-lane road trying to negotiate the traffic. So, I mean, it's doable, and once bike lanes are established on the major arteries on the streets, I think it'll be even better. And Ray is one of the people that's working hard to get those established at this point.
Okay. I just know from my own experience, Jim, that Indianapolis, I think I told you this on the phone the other day when we spoke, was one of my favorite states, Indiana, that is. Indianapolis was kind of a little bit of a tougher nut to crack, but it was really the smorgasbord of roads that you have to choose from there in Indiana is phenomenal. If you don't like the way one road shows up, there's another one. You can kind of turn left and zigzag and find your way off to where you need to be. And so I guess Indianapolis is like that as well, huh? The actual city?
It is. I mean, on my commuter route, I probably add about 5 miles extra onto the route, but I'm able to get off the major streets. I ride along a Fall Creek, ride along the White River for a while. I ride through some really pretty residential areas where you're out of traffic, and it's just an enjoyable ride no matter what season it is.
Okay, so now, Jim, let's get to the punchline, of what I really wanted to talk to you about today here in the middle of our Mayor's Ride busyness. You've got an article in mind that about what we the cyclists can do to change the attitudes of car drivers, those with whom we share the road. So what can we do from the saddle?
Well, just to back up just a little bit before we get to it, the thing I noticed, I've taken my sons on a few trips riding across Ireland and in Italy, and what I noticed is that the whole culture there seems to be much more tolerant towards bicyclists, and I began to wonder why that is, why it's different than the U.S. And I think cyclists tend to think of motorists in extreme ways. You know, when there's a get-together of bicyclists, we tend to try and recount stories of encounters, bad encounters with motorists, and yet we overlook all the little courteous acts, or at least tolerant acts, that motorists do on the same road. And, I think what happens over time is that we get on the roads expecting the worst, and sometimes it does happen. But I think that there are some things that we can do. You know, why is Italy or Ireland different than the U.S.? And I think a lot has to do with over generations, an attitude change has taken place. If you think of about how behavior is transferred from generation to generation, it's through children. So children, for example, are riding in the car with their parents, and if they see their parents act aggressively towards bicyclists, they're more likely to do that when they begin driving. But if, on the other hand, if they see them acting in a courteous manner towards bicyclists, then they're more likely to drive in that manner when they, when they're of age. So I think that there's a slow process that we could start here in the U.S. Where more courteous acts by motorists or more courteous attitudes towards bicyclists will occur. So I think that the things, as a psychologist, what really changes behavior is reinforcement. I think that it's well established that if you reward a behavior, it's more likely to occur in the future. So from the saddle, what I've been trying to do over my years as a commuter, I ride the same routes every day, the same time of day. So I see the same mailman, I see the same elderly people sitting on their porches, the same kids who, so I wave, and I began waving to these people, just noticing them, just sitting on the porches and the kids. So now I go through a neighborhood and the kids will yell, hey, biker dude, and ride with me for a while, and the same neighborhood will ride. But I'm sure I also see the same motorists because I'm going at the same time of day. And what I've noticed over a period of time is that I rarely get honked at it anymore. People are more courteous towards me. And what I do are some very specific behaviors. In order to change attitude, it's kind of a well-known literature through psychological research, that if you could anchor an attitude towards some behavioral act, that attitude will change to be consistent with the behavior. So what I try and do when I encounter motorists is several things. One is I try and make eye contact with the motorist. And the reason I do that, one, is for safety, just to make sure that they know that I'm there. But the second thing is that it personalizes this brief relationship that I have with the motorist. The second thing I try and do is I try and acknowledge any conceivable courteous act that they might make. So, you know, the obvious ones are you come to a four-way stop and the motorist waves you through. Okay, well, that's an overt act, and I always acknowledge that. I give a wave or a head nod, either a wave back. Almost every time you do that, you get something back from the motorist. So they may wave back, or they may nod their head towards you. But I try and expand it to almost every other act, too, whether it's someone who doesn't, you know, is waiting to make a left-hand turn, and they wait until you pass the intersection. I give them a nod, too, even if I know that they had no intent to be courteous. And often those people will respond back. And what it does is it sets up an attitude change in the motorist's mind. Essentially, someone is acknowledging their courteous act. Okay, so they made this behavioral act, or at least someone thinks that they made this courteous act. And it's what happens for attitude change is that over time, their attitudes will change, so they begin to see themselves as being courteous towards bicyclists. Now, if their kids are in the car, then they observe their parents doing, you know, being tolerant or if not courteous towards bicyclists. So when they get older and they're able to drive, they begin to act and behave in the same manner, because children model much behavior from their parents. And I think that's how cultures change over, again, this is over generations, but I've noticed it just in a few years since I had to change my bike route to accommodate a change where the place I do consulting moved. So I think that these are little things that we can do from the saddle to change motorist behavior and actually change cultures over a long period of time.
Well, Jim, that's just absolutely great stuff. Thank you. It's been absolutely wonderful and great and exciting talking to you on this Sunday, Memorial Day Sunday. I'm going to let you go back and enjoy your Memorial Day festivities. Let's see, you're a Hoosier. What do Hoosiers do on Memorial Weekend?
Well, a lot of them are at the race, which is going on as we speak.
Okay.
I'm not interested in motor. I call it motor entertainment because I get upset when they call it motor sports.
Right, thank you. thank you for that.
But I'm actually at the office working on some reports because in a few days I'm taking my bicycle to Italy for another cycle touring, and I've got to get a lot of work done before I can leave. So,
wow.
That's how I'm spending Memorial Day.
Great. Okay, well, I hope that you're not going to be there for Indianapolis NVG Day on Tuesday, but you'll be on the plane.
Yeah, I'll be on a plane. I wish I could be. I've done a lot of work burning up the email lines trying to get people out for that, letting them know what's going on.
All right. So all right, Jim. Wow.
Terrific.
Well, I thank you for you, and I thank you for the time you took for us today. It's been kind of fun and an honor and all that kind of stuff.
No problem. It's been fun for me, too, Martin. All right, Jim. And I hope that we get to meet face-to-face here soon.
Yeah, probably 07. 07 when I come through, guy. Right, man. All right, Jim. Thank you.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future, and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.